so am I still waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight.
Listen to Revue.
Welcome to the very first ever WCW Mayhem on this November 21st, 1999.
The Templar, of course, went through the tournament really the hard way if you think about it. His opening match in this tournament was against a man who's become his archenemy in Dean Malenko and propelled him on into the next round, and he went up against Medusa. And that's another story in itself. He gave up. Not get his shoulders pinned. So the powers that be told Kurt Hennig to get his shoulders pinned, be out of here. And by hook or crook at Yoko K. Ghost Brain, he has stayed alive in WCW.
This is a slobber knocker. This is a slobber knocker, ladies and gentlemen. Oh my God! With God as my witness, they've broken him in half.
Kimberly, I know you're in here. Don't you want to play with me anymore?
I guess he's losing after me. I don't know what he's going to do.
I'm going to tell you exactly what he's going to do. Kind of like deja vu, isn't it? This time, it's going to be more than a spanking.
How much more can Vicious take? He's going to have to give up. Hold on.
What if the dinosaurs were still alive?
John Pollock and Wei Ting. This is Review Away, and I am here with clearly a chilly Wei Ting. You got a jacket on, got a toque.
It's really cold.
And a coffee.
It's very cold. I don't know, for some reason, my wing of the office is always very cold. Not like here.
Well, here in this particular studio, which doubles over as my office, it can be very cool. As you look above, you can notice that used to be a ventilator, and now it's been destroyed. So some days I'll walk in here, and it's like ice. And then there's other days it's a microwave. It has a great extreme variance when it comes to the heating in here. This is actually pretty good.
Yeah, I don't know why this, for the most part, this place likes to crank up the AC. I don't know if that's just because there are a lot of machines here that might overheat.
I have no idea.
I don't know.
I don't think any of our listeners really care, unfortunately.
Well, how much do they care about anything we talk about?
That's a great point.
If it comes out of our mouths, I think they will be forced to listen.
What are you drinking? Where's that that coffee from?
I have a latte with almond milk.
A latte with almond milk?
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds very
fancy.
Yeah.
Douchebaggy? Is that what you're going to say?
No, not douchebaggy, but very kind of tree-hugging.
Tree-hugging?
That's kind of...
am lactose intolerant. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh.
In fact, I had...
Bullshit, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
We've had this conversation. Something like 90% of Asians are lactose intolerant.
Wow.
It's just not in our history. We don't drink milk from cows.
Yeah. I don't recall. I guess I don't always process what you tell me, but that's an interesting fact.
You're maybe you're intolerant to my voice.
Or to
information.
Or to lactose.
What?
Intolerant.
What are you talking about?
You said you're lactose intolerant, so
yeah?
Maybe, I don't know. I'm drinking Starbucks with non-fat milk.
You're not drinking, you're just a regular coffee? Is that Christmas blend?
This is the Christmas blend. They've got, this year, the Christmas blend, which is a darker roast, and they have the holiday blend, which is like a blonde roast. Mm. I like how Starbucks, yes, they do have the holiday blend, but they're not one of these stupid companies that refuse to say the word Christmas. There is nothing that irritates me more than these people who feel the need to decipher what we call December the 25th.
Yeah, what else would you call it?
If you get offended by the word Christmas, here's something you can get offended by. Go fuck yourself.
Oh, you mean like people who instead of saying, oh, don't say Christmas, say Happy Holidays.
Yeah. It drives me absolutely insane.
Yeah, I don't like
absolutely
that.
Insane. That's like these same people who were getting outraged about red poppies this year. Did you hear this? This was the thing.
You mean because white poppies?
Well, both. The response to red poppies was white poppies because they felt that red poppies glorified war.
Right.
I don't know of one person that has ever put on a poppy saying, ah, the good old days when we were fighting other countries.
Yeah. So what...
What's wrong? What is fucking wrong with people,
explain,
man?
The white poppies. What is that?
Listen, I only found this out because I really wasn't engaged in this whole debate last week. I was totally fixed on Rob Ford.
Explain what the concept of poppies to our foreign listeners.
Oh, right. Because we did get... for some of our videos that we did for Fight News Now Extra, we did get some responses of... What are those red buttons they're wearing? Some people thought they were microphones. It was very confusing. In Canada, in the lead up to Remembrance Day, which takes place every November the 11th, similar to Veterans Day in the U.S., it's you wear a poppy, which is a red, I guess, like flower-like pin.
Yeah, they're
put above your heart.
The replicas of the poppy flower.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Yeah, from the poem In Flanders Field.
Yeah, exactly. I imagine our British listeners will be very familiar as well.
So you wear this every year to, you know, pay tribute to those that have defended our country, have given us, you know, a lot of freedoms that we enjoy today.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of acknowledging those that helped build and preserve this country.
Absolutely.
So this year, because we don't have enough stuff to complain about, some people looked at it and said, oh, well, red, it's glorifying war. I have no idea. My whole knowledge of this comes from Jason Agnew telling me about this on Sunday night.
No way, like, because of the color red or simply what it represents, the fact that we're celebrating...
I don't care what it is.
Yeah.
I don't know how that is your conclusion from a poppy.
No,
if this is bothering you during a day-to-day, this is your problem, guess what? You don't have real problems. The men and women that fought for this country, they had real problems.
Like, I met, you know, the people that had, you know, that fought in the war had to fight. Like, I don't know if they really had much of a choice. And so it's not like we're celebrating, you know.
How to remember them. That's what this argument is about.
It's not like we're celebrating the idea of war. In fact, we're like, you know, it's almost like remembering how much of a tragedy it was that, you know, it all had to take place.
Drives me absolutely insane.
Yeah, no, it's...
I will say Christmas many, many a time. No one...
Go ahead.
No one in the history of mankind has ever said Merry Christmas as a way to just stick it to Jewish people.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, maybe there have been, I don't know.
I will guarantee you there's not been one.
You know...
John Pollock's science says no one has ever said it with that intent.
Maybe there's like a really, I don't know, ironic friend of yours who's going to maybe some type of Hanukkah celebration with, I don't know, Santa
what,
Claus.
What if, is there anything in particular as an Asian Canadian?
Yeah.
Do you get offended by certain things like that maybe to others are trivial? If someone were referring to you as a... You know, mistakenly identifying you as Japanese. Or calling you Oriental, for instance.
I can see how, like, I know to some people, like our mayor, Rob Ford,
one of
the criticisms that was laid against him was he had a big rant at City Hall.
These Orientals, they work like dogs, was his comment.
He said that, and I was like, thanks. What a compliment.
That's how I honestly believe he intended it to mean.
I know. He's saying we work really hard. So I don't know if it's always true, but some people take offense to the term Oriental. I think it sounds nice. I don't think it. To me, I don't get offended. I think it's based on how you're saying it. You could say, you know. Like, you could say the word Chinese and have it sound really nasty and, you know. Like,
sure.
So I don't really get offended. I mean, if you are going to say, like, chink or gook or something,
that's probably coming from a hateful place.
Yeah, I would assume so. Unless you're a rapper. Like, if you're, like, a Chinese rapper. Yo.
Is that big in Chinese rap culture, that word?
No, I don't think so.
It's not as prevalent?
No, I don't think so. But, like, you know, like, black people saying the N-word, you know. I think it all depends how you say it. Whether or not we each have the right to say it, that's another story. I propose that we share. You know, you can say derogatory word for me, but I could say it to you, obviously in a non-hateful way. We're just saying it like, you know, come on.
What's,
like we're friends.
What's such an offensive term for a white man? Like, you call it, like in Japan, isn't it?
Gaijin?
Guailo. Or
no, that's in like Cantonese.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's not even offensive. It's just like how we.
I always thought that was an offensive
describe
word
people.
For white folk.
Yeah, but, well,
Gaijin, which pro wrestlers they take that as a badge of honor to be called that. That's just what the
just
foreigners
means,
were referred
it
to
just
as.
Means foreigner. Yeah. That's I don't know. Again, it's all about intent and the context with which you're using these words.
What are your thoughts when we go back and we'll watch some WWF or whatever wrestling show from the mid '90s, and you'll hear a faggot chant, which was prevalent at that time. Like, there, we've reviewed tons of events where that's a chant that you hear.
Yeah. You know, that's... when it comes to, homosexual rights, I find, like, that's really...
Because I'm pretty embarrassed when I hear wrestling fans, you know, in context.
But I feel like that's something that we've, at least as a... I don't know, maybe a Toronto society or North American society. I feel like that's...
I think that's a pretty taboo word today.
But it's really changed... Something that's really changed over the past, you know, 10, 15 years, where, like, I feel like 15 years ago, maybe you watch an ECW show, and that's totally acceptable.
I bring this up because that was a chant from this past Saturday's Brazil card, a level towards Cesar Ferreira.
Oh, okay. Well,
and
the crowd
was chanting that.
It's a different culture. It's a different society than you know, what we're used to up here. And I feel like eventually that'll all change. I feel like, you know, the world will start to... I don't know, treat the word a bit more seriously, but it's something that... It's
I think that's a pretty frowned upon word already. I think that's, you know, you say
but not
that
everywhere,
word.
Evidently.
Oh, and amongst... I would say that, you know, of any public note, if someone were to say that, you're going to get incredible backlash towards that, and probably have to apologize it if you're in any position of recognizability.
But I imagine the N-word to be the same, you know, many years past. So I think it's something that's on its way to completely changing, but we've already seen a lot of changes over the past, I don't know, decade or so around here.
What an interesting discussion to start our first 10 minutes here.
Sure.
Worldwide philosophical views.
Yeah.
How's everything else?
Good. Yeah.
Good. No one's offended you today.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Well, wait.
Not even the show that you finished watching today. It didn't offend you.
Well, it was really boring at certain parts. I will say that.
Well, this was the WCW Mayhem event. Sunday, November the 21st of 1999 from Toronto, Ontario. And what I remember the most, actually, from this dateway was that there was a Pride event going on this very same day. And it was Kazushi Sakuraba, his first time he beat one of the Gracie brothers in... Hoyler.
Oh, wow.
And this would then lead into the Grand Prix the next year, where he would go 90 minutes with Hoist Gracie, and this started the legendary Sakuraba Gracie Hunter storyline in Pride, which was really the program that just led to Pride exploding.
Yeah.
And I always remember November 21st was that legendary fight, but little did we know that across the world, another legendary event going down from the Air Canada Center in WCW Mayhem.
Yeah. I guess so.
Which I kind of, I was reminiscing with both Dan Lavransky and Jason Agnew Sunday night. I was saying, you know, we're reviewing Mayhem this week, the first event where we all met. And I kind of felt sad because, and Dan was like, oh, we should have done it all together. I was like, oh, I felt kind of bad.
Hey, we could stop right now.
Maybe we should.
Yeah.
Well, I almost did the swerve, actually, on the weekend because, not getting ahead of ourselves, but me and Wei are already aware of what we're going to review next week. And I ended up watching that first. And I was going to say, let's just swap weeks, but we can't now.
Oh, shit. Well, we can...
I think next week's... It might have been more timely this week, but I think it would have been lost in a lot of stuff this week that would be of a similar theme.
Yeah.
So that'll be coming up next week. We'll save that for the end of the show, what we're going to review.
Right. Okay.
Get a polarizing...
We can always review this show two times.
Yeah, we might get to that point one day where we review a show twice, and this would be, I think, at the top of the list of shows to review twice.
Why not?
Yeah.
WCW Mayhem.
Mouth was like, oh, it's okay. Well, maybe we can all review another show that we all went to. Maybe we'll do WrestleMania 18. Like, we reviewed that one, too.
Yeah. What happened? We did SummerSlam 2003.
Four. Was the one in here in Toronto. Were you at that event?
No.
That was before
Watched at O'Grady's. With my
you watched
friends.
At O'Grady's?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah, that was legendary event in law history.
No. Where was it really?
It was where Mouth had quite a few beers at that
show.
Oh,
yes, yes.
And then it was just such an energy. There's two law shows in history that I wish had been preserved, and they haven't been. There was that night, because him and Agnew just argued, and Mouth just disagreed with everything. Like,
yeah.
Those aren't the call letters. Like, just everything he was yelling at Agnew about. And the other one was a very famous show from when Hulk Hogan's book came out, and Jeff Merrick reviewed the book for an hour. And he just went, like, page by page, and he just debunked all these Hogan bullshit stories.
Yes.
And I remember listening at the time, and it was him solo. For whatever reason, Mouth wasn't on the show that week. It was one of my favorite episodes ever. Just him, the book report episode. It was so great. Just amazing.
Oh, it's too bad those aren't around. Were
I know. There was a time period where all the shows were... It was really only the interviews that were saved on minidisc for so long, and it wasn't until the Fight Network purchased the law, and in 2005... when we kind of adjusted our roles, that we started saving every single show. And from, I would guess, March of 2005 up to the present, every show has been saved. And it's just bits and pieces before that. We have all our interviews, but in terms of shows, it's unless there was a live guest on,
yeah.
I don't think the shows were saved, unfortunately. I actually have a bunch on cassette from when I was just a listener.
Mm-hmm.
But like back in like 1999 that I still have. But man, just going back to tie it into this, I took out my VHS of WCW Mayhem. And man, VHS just doesn't hold up, man. It's like,
no.
It just eats up your tape. And it's like, why did I save all these fucking tapes? They're useless now.
No, apparently somebody told me that they actually do fetch quite, you know, certain choppers and bidders on eBay. So
I really want to transfer some of these over to like a digital file, because they're in a storage unit right now.
Well,
where...
why do you even need to do that? Because even this show you could find on YouTube readily.
I know. Well, I like to think that all the money I spent on VHS tapes and the time I put into this is like... not for nothing, which effectively it is, because everything I have in that storage area is probably a few types away on my laptop.
And so you're going to waste even more time digitizing all this stuff?
Well,
so
for there's certain stuff that, listen, will not be preserved online.
Like what?
Like an episode of Raw from the Sky Dome, maybe.
I guarantee you that's already online.
Well, it very well may be.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
I feel just...
In case you ever get the itch to want to watch the Raw from Skydome.
I've got a box set of Stampede wrestling tapes that they released in like 1999. It's five tapes of Stampede footage. So it's like, it's hours of Stampede wrestling that I'm sure I couldn't find online.
Okay.
And then WWF buys that library. We've seen nothing from Stampede.
All
it's
right.
So little that they put out. The Hard Anthology DVD was about it.
I suppose like some of the tape trading things that you collected. Yeah, those are probably what
I've got a Best of Dynamite Kid tape.
That's
from
cool.
From New Japan.
Yeah.
I've got a whole tape of Misawa Kobashi match. Those actually are pretty easy to find, actually.
Right. Well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
You go ahead.
That's a documentary right there.
Yeah, John Pollock's tape collection.
Yeah. You should you should come and it can be a whole... I would watch 90 minutes of someone going through it. A whole, like, one-year process of going through their wrestling tapes and finding stuff.
Then we'd probably end up with even more tape of the documentary.
No, we'd just get, like, a one giant, like, MP4 file or something.
Instead of a tape?
Instead.
Okay.
Nonetheless, I took out the tape of Mayhem, and I went to go put it in my VCR, and I had a cassette, a VHS copy.
Can you actually one day, next time you go down there, just shoot a video and upload it to all of us so that we can see
it? I will, because if anyone could see, when I have to like dig out a tape from my storage area, it's a 20-minute job.
I'll follow you, and I'll film it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, you can put it on your Instagram.
Okay.
It'll be a big draw.
You'll have to do it in 15 seconds, but...
That's all you can put on Instagram video, 15 seconds?
Yeah.
Wow. How long are vines?
Six.
Six. Jesus Christ.
But people get really creative with vines. Like they're almost kind of like comic strips, you know.
Yeah.
Like you just shoot a frame here, a frame there, and then you have a whole story in 6 seconds.
Do you use Vine?
No,
just Instagram.
Yeah,
and you like Instagram?
I like it. Yeah, I don't even really use the video feature.
You're a big filter guy. You enjoy,
of course,
the filters.
That's the whole point.
I wouldn't have the time to use filters.
Well, you don't even have the capacity.
I don't even know how to post anything on Instagram.
No, I mean your phone can't even doesn't have enough memory or something.
Sometimes I don't know. I don't know what the deal is with my phone.
Yeah,
it works for the important stuff.
Yeah, no, it's a fun little thing.
One of the greatest things of the iPhone is the Wi-Fi that I can just get. You get an instant Wi-Fi connection.
What do you mean?
If I'm out somewhere. And my laptop, if I'm not in a Wi-Fi zone...
Oh, it searches for Wi-Fi.
I just... No. I mean, I can make my phone its own Wi-Fi setup.
Okay.
So if I'm somewhere that isn't connected to the internet, I just flip the tab on my phone, and then I can log on.
Yeah, using the 3G.
Yes.
Is what you mean. Yeah.
Gotcha. That's a great feature.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Huge selling point.
I mean, you can get that with Androids, too. It's not just the iPhone.
Oh, well...
Tethering.
It works.
That's what they call it.
Yeah, tethering.
Yeah.
I appreciate the technical term. Next
no
time I tether, I'll let you know.
Okay.
All right. Let's get into Mayhem here. My story was when I went to put my Mayhem tape in, I had a VHS copy of the movie Casino, and it got chewed up by my VCR trying to take it out to put Mayhem in. So when I saw the remnants of what was Casino, I ended up watching Mayhem online.
No.
So VHS was of no use to me. November 21st, 1999. This was... a historic day in law history. The first time I ever met Dan the Mouth Lavransky and Jason Agnew, who I sat in the fourth row with, along with my brother.
You just sat... How did you end up there? Because you weren't working on this.
I was not working with the law at the time. Neither was my brother at the time. My brother, for those that are new listeners, he preceded
Jeff.
Me. My brother, Jeff, he worked for the law before I did. I found this show... I think it was their very first night on the Fan 590, because I always listened to the Fan 590, and all of a sudden... this wrestling show came on at like 1 in the morning, and I was just blown away that they were talking about wrestling,
mm-hmm.
and like knew their shit. It was like unreal.
Yep.
It would have been the first time I ever heard Dave Meltzer.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. And then my brother started listening as well, because he was a big, big like wrestling fan at the time. And then this would have been later that year, and they did a contest on the law where they had tickets, ringside tickets to Mayhem. And what you had to do was create a sign and then come down to the Fan 590 studios and show your sign. So my brother made a sign. He went down to the Fan 590. You had to be there for when the show ended on a Saturday afternoon. And he won the tickets. And then he came home and he's like, "Do you want to go to Mayhem? I won the tickets." I was like, "Yeah, I'd like to go."
What did the sign say?
I can't remember. Should have invited my brother.
Are you
to come
sure?
On.
You sure you can't remember?
I honestly cannot remember. Like,
okay.
It wasn't me that made the sign. I don't know. I think it had to be some sign mentioning the law in it or something like that.
Did you guys bring the sign to the show?
No, didn't bring
what?
The sign.
Well, then what was the point of the contest?
You're in the fourth row. You're not going to distract people.
People do it all the time.
Yeah.
Fourth row is the perfect place to have a sign.
Yeah, he didn't bring it. It was his sign. He chose not to bring it.
I would have been pissed if I was one of the contests, if I was the law back
well,
then.
Well, this was a huge weekend because the night before, the WWF ran a house show at the Sky Dome.
Oh, wow.
Which actually did more people and a bigger gate than Mayhem did, the pay-per-view the next day. And there was a theory at the time because the WWF show ran super late. And it was the idea, and it was like kind of this old school thinking that, you know, when a competitor is in the same market the next day, you keep the fans up so late that they're kind of tired of wrestling and they're not going to come back the next day for the competitor's show. And there was some thought to that being...
Maybe that's why they decided on 3-hour Raws, so that nobody would want to dare...
Well, the unfortunate part is that usually SmackDown is in a neighboring city, so they're kind of working against themselves, running a 4-hour taping the night before, asking you to, you know, 2 hours away, we're going to have a SmackDown taping.
So fourth row, sitting next to Dan and Jay, what were your first impressions of them?
I remember Dan Lavransky being like... looking nothing like I anticipated
him to be. He gets that a lot.
I thought that he was like this... I thought he would be like this bulky, like, jock, almost. Like a football player or something. Because all I was going by was the voice.
Uh-huh.
And he would do the Jabroni of the Week
yep.
each week. So I really... That's what I imagine some big testosterone fueled.
He is.
I guess
he's
so.
He's a pretty big testosterone fueled. Filled man.
I guess so. And I guess I didn't really have much of a... I don't know if I had... No, I had definitely not met Jason Agnew prior, and it was... I don't know where Merrick would have been for the show, but it was me, my brother, and then with Agnew and Mouth, and we were sitting in the fourth row. So,
and did you guys get along? Did you guys have a chat?
I'm sure we did. I can't remember specifics. I do remember that I got to the show, and it was like a half hour before the pay-per-view was to start, and I looked over, and not more than 200 feet away from me was Vince Russo, just out amongst the people, just looking on, and he was just had this, like, this stare. He was just staring at the ring with his arms crossed, and I was like, I wonder what he's thinking. And I remember making my way over. I had to go around the ring area to the other ringside area, and I was going to go up to him to try and talk to him, but he bolted.
You were going to go talk to Vince Russo?
Yeah.
What about?
Well, because I don't know what I was going to ask him, but I was figuring, because like he hadn't been on television at this point. I'm like, no one knows that that's the head of creative here at WCW. And I would have been, 1999, I would have been 15 at the time. So I was going to go over, and... I was figuring, I was like,
get an exclusive.
He probably is never stopped by anybody. No one knows who this guy is.
Yeah.
And he's the most important person here that's running this show right now. So I just went over. I probably didn't have any idea in mind of what I was going to ask him. Would have been a hilarious conversation in hindsight, but maybe he could sense some bad karma. And he just bolted to the backstage area. By the time I got there, he was gone. And as I got there, I was standing next to Doug Dillinger, and I didn't have anything to ask Doug Dillinger, the head of security. So,
were you doing Jaws at the time?
I would have been.
John's audio wrestling show?
It might have been winding down at that point, because I started Jaws, my internet radio show, with my best friend at the time. His name was Sean, and we started it in, like, July of 1999. It was hosted on, like, GeoCities, and I was just blown away. He was the computer guy. I was like, dude, I don't know anything about how to get a fucking audio file onto a computer. And
how do I get my voice onto this
thing? He like hooked us up with Real Player, and we recorded our stuff. We bought these shitty microphones. We even got like some correspondence from the U.S. that we could call on the internet.
Whoa.
For 1999, it was like blowing my mind that we could get this out there. And we probably had two listeners. But once school started in September of that year, there was definitely, we started to go our separate ways. And I think wrestling was cool to him for the summer of 1999, but as school begun, it was, I always remember, he was like, it was just all of a sudden, we were doing the shows more infrequently, and he was like, still watching that wrestling stuff? It was like, that was the confirmation. It was over with.
That wrestling stuff.
Yeah. It was demoralizing. Yeah. So I would say we were clinging by the jaws of life at this point to that show. It was fading quickly. So that would have been the status of that. Were you watching WCW at this time? Were you at this event? Are you going to blow my mind and say you were in the fifth row right behind me?
I was not, unfortunately. No, and I know, I don't think I really was. I might have been watching like very casually, because WCW was on a Wednesday night here. Nitro was delayed for
two days. Yeah, it was Wednesdays, and then Thunder would have still been Thursdays at this
point. So I never made it a priority to watch like Raw, but I believe I was watching Raw at this time, but just not so much of WCW. But I was listening to The Law.
So the announcers for this show were Tony Schiavone and Bobby Heenan. We had an opening video on the WCW title tournament, and we've reviewed this show, Halloween Havoc 1999, where it ended with, it featured midway through the show, Hulk Hogan laying down for WCW champion Sting, just laying down. It was a shoot. And then later that night, Bill Goldberg challenged Sting for an impromptu WCW title match, beat Sting, and then the next night it was declared it wasn't a title change, pissing off people, one of many dusty finishes, and they were vacating the title, and they were going to start a 31-man, one-woman tournament for the vacant title. It was a tournament that one day we should go back and revisit some of those Nitros, because this is largely regarded as one of the weaker tournaments in wrestling history, where My God.
No, that's a lot of matches.
Listen, the WCW title was pretty hurt by this point, and this tournament was designed to put heat on the title. Like, that's what a tournament is typically designed to do. It's like all your focus is on everyone in the company gunning for this title because it's so important. And that was the build-up for this show, was this 32-man tournament on television leading into the Final Four on pay-per-view. The highlight of Tony Schiavone and Bobby Heenan's limited on-cameras during this pay-per-view was this fan that was positioned right in between them as they were talking. And he would point to Heenan and give a thumbs up. Then he pointed to Schiavone, thumbs down.
Huh.
And then he points to Heenan and did a drinking sign like he was drunk.
Huh.
And then the best part of this is all I could focus on. He puts his fist up. And I was like, what's he doing? Is he trying to make a heart? And then he counts the segment down. 5,
nice.
4. He's watching the cameraman count them down. And then he throws and we go to the back. This guy was awesome.
Oh, that's funny.
It was so funny. I encourage everyone to go back on this Mayhem pay-per-view and watch this dude with the black curly hair. Especially his high point was this first segment.
And we also encourage anybody who's ever in a similar situation at a live show to do the same thing.
His countdown I cried. It was so funny. There was also a Honky Tonk Man Still Rules sign right here to the side of Schiavone. Uh-huh. And tons of We Want Brett chants here in Toronto. Well, I mean, this crowd, there were times they were really checked out of this show, but man, were they really hot for Bret Hart at the start of this show. They had bought tickets for one man.
Was this show sold out?
No, it was not sold out.
Oh, wow.
Which was really a surprise to people because Nitro came in March of that year. It sold out in like minutes. Mm-hmm. It was a huge success. I went to that show by myself. It was one of my low points of social interaction because I had no one to go with, and I so badly wanted to go to Nitro. And I went by myself.
Yeah.
Loser.
Hey, no.
One week when you're away, I should review that by myself to really give everyone the actual accounting of watching a wrestling show by myself. I left that show telling myself I'm never, ever going to a show by myself again.
No, John, come on.
I didn't have a Wei Ting at that point in my life.
No, I think it just shows that you have a lot of self-confidence to be able to go and be like, you know, I like this thing. I'm going to go and enjoy it. Screw what my friends who don't like it.
Dude, it wasn't the same. It was like, it would be like going to someone's wedding by yourself and not knowing anybody.
Okay.
Where everyone's having a great time.
I've done that, but I've also left early at those.
Yeah. Everyone's enjoying themselves. Yeah. It was like, I'm just sitting there. I couldn't drink at the time. I'm 15.
Yeah.
It's like, what to do here? Anyway, so this much better, for me at least here. I had people to interact with at this show.
Yeah.
But not sold out, which I think tells you a little bit about a number of factors. I mean, there was a show the night before, which I did go to, and then there was...
The product
was, Russo came in and it had a lot of, amongst the internet crowd, I mean, a lot of optimism. Like, here's the guy from the WWF with Ed Ferrara. They were coming in. There was a hope that, man, this is really going to inject some life into what was a pretty ailing product in 1999, but still one that, still doing very good television numbers. They did like 13,000 or so people here at the Air Canada Center, so not like they had an embarrassing audience.
Why didn't the WWE run until much later? The ACC.
Because at the time they had a deal with the Sky Dome, and I think that they had just an existing deal at that point, and then they would run one more show at the Sky Dome in March of 2000, and then after that they got into the Air Canada Center in October of 2000 and run their first show.
I see, okay.
So I think it was just a building arrangement, but Jeff Jarrett and Chris Benoit kicked us off in the semifinals of the tournament. The crowd was very hot here. It seemed that Bret Hart and Chris Benoit were like the two big baby faces on this show.
Absolutely.
For obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Benoit had a maple leaf on his tights.
Yes.
Just to emphasize, I'm Canadian.
Oh, yes.
The Canadian crippler. Everyone got it? Early on, the crowd's going nuts here for the chops. They go to the floor. Jarrett drives Benoit crotch first into the post. And Schiavone mentions... the opening round of the tournament, where Benoit hit a swan dive off the cage to Dean Malenko in a, quote, moment we'll never forget. And then he faced Medusa in the second round. A match we have to hunt down, the Benoit-Medusa Classic.
Yeah.
That pretty much tells you the tournament right there. And then he faced Medusa. Benoit got out of a suplex. He hit Jarrett with a jawbreaker, hit the German suplexes. Then Creative Control came down to the ring. You want to explain what Creative Control was?
Well, they were the Harris twins. And
yeah, they were a tag team called Creative Control. Patrick and Gerald, as a playoff of Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe.
There you go. Just two big men in suits, twins, would just come in and beat up people.
They were all over this show.
Yeah.
Just attached to the hip of Jeff Jarrett.
Mm-hmm.
There was a series of near falls by Benoit. He hit a belly-to-back suplex. He went for the diving headbutt, but then Creative Control pulls Jarrett to the floor. Someone is distracting the referee. Then the other Harris brother attacks Benoit in the ring. Jarrett hits the stroke. He goes for the pin, but then Dustin Rhodes appears at ringside, pulling Jarrett out to the floor, fights with Creative Control. Then Jarrett gets knocked into one of the Harris brothers, who has a guitar on the apron. Benoit grabs the guitar, hits Jarrett over the top of the head. Charles Robinson, he doesn't even pretend not to see this guitar. It's just whatever. And he counts the pin, 9 minutes and 28 seconds, where Chris Benoit gets the win. And after the match, Creative Control and Jarrett attack Benoit. And they kind of played the storyline here that they had the powers that be, and they had their chosen one, Jeff Jarrett. And they explained that this is opening up the pay-per-view so Jeff Jarrett can have as much time possible to recover in order to compete in the finals, and he lost this match to Benoit.
Mm-hmm. I thought overall, technically, the match was excellent. I thought Jarrett and Benoit did very well. Everything was pretty flawlessly executed. But then you get into a lot of the overbooking that I found ruined a lot of the matches on this show.
Yeah, these run-ins, I mean, there were so many of them.
And
here,
it just made the referees look so dumb.
On countless
examples. With all these sloppily done distractions. The crowd was just amazing from the get-go here. Just like that classic Toronto crowd that, you know, like I've been to shows recently, and it's not really the same, but like back then, they were just like nuts. Really, really nuts. And it made this match even better. Like this crowd was so crazy, even after the match, that like security, you could see they had to hold the barricades back to avoid from collapsing.
Yeah, it was a pretty rabid crowd at different parts of the show. Yeah, this match was kind of just typical of this time period where, okay, we've got a one-on-one match where Chris Benoit is going to advance to the finals. That's essentially, like, that's what we want to get out of this segment. But it was like, no, we got to get more. We got to emphasize the Creative Control run-in. Dustin Rhodes is now feuding with Jeff Jarrett. Yeah. It was just, there was so much added to it that by the end of this, it's like, okay, my brain can't process everything that's going on here, but you're asking me to. And you multiply that by a 3-hour pay-per-view or a 3-hour Nitro, and that to me was just typical of the time where just so much was needed,
yeah.
And it was like less could be a lot more. Just give us straight match. I think people would have been more than happy here. Jarrett, something messes up, and yeah, he loses.
It just starts to mean nothing when you do it so often.
Mike Tenay is in the back with Disco Inferno, the Cruiserweight champion. Their microphone was constantly dying on them here. And they establish here that Disco Inferno is in a lot of debt. But if he wins this match, for some reason there's $25,000 that goes to the winner.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is like they're trying for the fight of the night bonus or something like that. And Jarrett and Creative Control then show up and they beat up Disco. And that takes us...
Why?
He was in their way, I guess. So Disco Inferno is defending the Cruiserweight Championship against Evan Courageous, who's managed by Medusa, who... What was Medusa here? She looked, all due respect, like a hooker.
Well, that was maybe a popular look back then.
She had this weird, like, part of her hair was dyed blue. Like, they had her in, like, this bikini top and...
Yeah.
Looked like someone that belonged a couple blocks north of the Air Canada Center.
Oh, that's not very nice.
That's what she looked like here.
I thought she looked nice.
Yeah?
She looked dolled up.
Yeah, well, she was a...
She was the girlfriend here of Evan Courageous.
She is most...
The MILF.
The MILF. That was her gimmick, I think.
Yeah.
Where she had one of the best law liners. It's like, this is Medusa... and you're listening to the law. That's loose, able, and willing.
Whoa.
So listen.
Yeah, that was a classic one.
Those were her words.
Loose, able, and willing. Well, she's just referring to you know, being limber for a wrestling match.
Of course. There was a sign here in the crowd, WCW, what Canadians watch?
Not,
which is
really?
not quite true. It's what a segment of the Canadian wrestling fans were watching at this late 90s period of professional wrestling. They explain here, Disco's life is on the line if he doesn't win this match. The Cruiserweight title and his life.
Well, the idea was that he was involved with the mob here, and that was exemplified by Tony Marinara being out there with him. And that's the debt that he owes, and if he doesn't pay it, then...
Tony Marinara, who would slowly... he would quickly be renamed Tony Mama Luke at the time. He joined Bobby Heenan and Tony Schiavone on commentary, and... I looked up Evan Courageous to see what this guy's been up to. After WCW went down, he would go on to appear in one of my favorite shows of all time, Passions, on NBC.
No, what did he do?
I don't know what his character was. I never saw him during his brief time on Passions. But he would also play himself in the movie Crazy Eyes that came out last year.
No. He played Evan Courageous?
He played Evan Courageous.
What is Crazy Eyes?
That's all I know. That's all the information I have.
Okay. He played himself?
Yeah.
As a former WCW wrestler?
I guess, yeah.
I'm going to look
Member of Three Count. There was a crucifix into a roll-up by Courageous for a two count. Disco goes off the apron to the floor and takes a drop kick in midair. Crowd was not into this at all. Marinara asks what he could get for hawking the Cruiserweight title, and Schiavone and Heenan guesstimate probably 50 grand or so. There was a boring chant here. Disco then goes up to Medusa and gets slapped. A real great babyface here. He's in debt, and then he gets shot down by the heel MILF. Tony Marinara then goes up to Medusa. He's hitting on her, and then he shows off her watch, which I guess Medusa was now interested, and Courageous gets very upset at this and goes after Tony Marinara. Disco then grabs a chair, goes for Evan Courageous, who gets out of the way, and Disco takes out Tony Marinara on the floor with the chair. He's all concerned that he's taken out this member of the mob. They go back into the ring, and Courageous hits a springboard crossbody and pins Disco Inferno. 7 minutes, 59 seconds, so Evan Courageous wins the Cruiserweight title, wins $25,000, and Disco Inferno loses his life.
I thought these both guys worked hard, but I just didn't think that the crowd really cared. In fact, there was a boring chant I heard. They're just not very over. But in fact, some of the gimmicky stuff on the outside seemed to get their attention.
I guess so. It was, I don't know, the Cruiserweight, I think there was a certain level of expectation, and Disco Inferno really didn't represent that to a lot of people.
Yeah, nor really Evan Courageous.
Bret Hart shows up at the Air Canada Centre with an extra-large second cup.
Oh, is that right?
It's clear he was sporting second cup there.
Okay.
Getting ready for his big match. Jeff Jarrett is with the powers that be. This was when Vince Russo was the mysterious figure, but it was much like George Steinbrenner on Seinfeld, where you would never see him. You would only hear him from behind his desk.
Yes.
And he's upset at Jeff Jarrett for blowing the match, and tonight he has to prove why he's the chosen one, or else he will be out of favor by the powers that be. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that means. It means we're not going to put you over in matches. We're not going to script you accordingly. I don't know what it means by being out of favor, but...
you won't get the same opportunities.
Gene Okerlund is with Screamin' Norman Smiley, who's wearing a Toronto Maple Leafs jersey. He freaks out over some construction work in the back, and it would go into our hardcore title match. This, a very historic matchway, because this was the match to crown the very first WCW Hardcore Champion.
Yeah.
Norman Smiley and Brian Knobbs.
A title that looked a lot like the ECW World Title.
Very much looked like the ECW title.
Yeah.
Russo's admitted him and Ferrara were huge fans of ECW, mm-hmm. So maybe they borrowed here, took
perhaps
from there. Schiavone compares Norman Smiley to then-Toronto Maple Leafs goalie Curtis Joseph. But here's something for the fact-checking thread. Comparing him to Curtis Joseph, and Smiley is dressed as a goalie wearing a Ty Domi jersey, though.
Oh, is he?
What the fuck?
He was also wearing these, like, old
pads from, like...
like the 1930s some, or something.
Yeah, some, like, Johnny Bauer-inspired.
Yeah, where did he get these pads from? The museum? Hockey Hall of Fame?
Brian Knobbs attacks him with a broom to start, and Hart Jimmy Hart is tossing a garbage can in, but then Smiley catches it and attacks Knobs with it. And Shivani's just getting out his hockey puns, yelling, "It's a power play for Screamin' Norman."
You remember the Mayhem video game?
I do. I did have it on Nintendo 64, but I don't recall it being a good game. This was post-THQ, and THQ took up the WWF games.
Because wasn't that, it was either this one or Backstage Assault that was like, it was Backstage Assault where you couldn't even wrestle in the game, you could only fight on the outside. I guess
that would have been Backstage Assault, I think.
Okay, so but in Mayhem, you could actually still wrestle?
I think so.
Okay.
As I recall.
Because I thought this might have been like...
Those games were shit.
Yeah, I thought this match might have been their way of promoting Backstage Assault.
Yeah, I can't remember those games too well. All I remember was, oh, this is where the WWF games are the ones you want to buy. Because they've got
those EA games sucked.
Yeah, not very good. That's what EA, they're now doing the UFC game.
I know. UFC Backstage.
Oh, that would be awesome. Yeah. You could be Nick Diaz and Joe Riggs. That'd be great. Go to a hospital. I don't know if this was meant to be the way it was taken by Bobby Heenan, but Jimmy Hart leaps onto the back of Norman Smiley. He gets thrown off, and Knobs comes from behind as they're going up the aisle and hits him from behind with a trash can. And Bobby Heenan says, "This is WCW. It doesn't get any better." I didn't know what that meant.
Anytime somebody says something like that, especially like in a WCW or TNA, like but more so in WCW.
Are they being cryptic?
I don't know. I don't know.
Could have been. They brawl up the aisle. They go into the back, which was such an overdone cliche by this point. Yeah. Like, it was cool the first one or two times when you got to see backstage where you never got to see, but then it just became every hardcore match.
What was this like for you, being live?
It sucked. The whole crowd booed it because it's like I paid to see these guys fight, and now I'm watching on a screen.
Right.
Something that I'm not that interested to begin with. And they fought into a food storage area where all these boxes were. They fought into an elevator, and Jimmy Hart's left outside of the elevator. The elevator then opens, and Jimmy Hart goes to hit the first person he sees, and he hits Knobs instead of Smiley.
I really like that finish, actually.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was very funny and done really well. And from what you could hear from the audience, like the audience really roared in laughter.
You know what the technical term is for this in MMA?
No.
A level change.
Oh, okay.
The elevator.
Yeah.
So Smiley then falls on top of Knobs, gets the win at 7 minutes and 29 seconds. Knobs is furious. He sends Jimmy Hart and Norman Smiley into a bunch of hot dog buns, and that was our first WCW Hardcore title match.
Well, I will say, as far as, you know, these plunder matches go, I thought this was really good. I thought they pretty much, like, Knobs especially, just went 100% with everything that they were throwing at each other. All these trash can lids and hockey sticks, they were hitting each other really hard with stuff. And I love the idea of Hardcore Warrior Norman Smiley. I think
he had a really funny character. He was enjoyable in this role. I can't go back and really enjoy these matches. I find them so overdone. At the time, though, Norman Smiley, I enjoyed him quite a lot. I was always a fan of Norman Smiley, and this at least gave him a character that the people did respond to.
Yeah, you get to see this kind of, you know, effeminate man get beaten up, you know, throughout the whole building with a guy like Brian Knobs, and then all of a sudden, I thought the finish was creative, so I enjoyed this as far as these matches go.
I wish that we could have chatted with Brian Knobs about this back in Hamilton. At the comic convention.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's right.
Could have brought up his classic in Toronto with Norman Smiley.
Yeah.
There's a video on the Filthy Animals Revolution angle. I can't really recap this angle, but these were highlights from the video. Torrey Wilson being put in a shark cage, Asia, and they hung Rey Mysterio by his leg from a steel cage.
A lot happens.
A lot was happening.
In a month.
Then we went to Mike Tenay, who is our backstage interviewer, with The Revolution, Shane Douglas, Asia, Dean Malenko, and my favorite, Perry Saturn. And basically, Shane Douglas, in his pleather jacket, is asked some what-if question, and he responds with all these what-if scenarios. What if, what if, what if? And Saturn then interrupts, saying, what if dinosaurs were still alive? And says they'd be wandering all over the place and crapping everywhere, just like filthy animals. And tonight they're going to exterminate the filthy animals just like they did the dinosaurs. And then, worried about a future fact-checking thread, said, I'm aware that man wasn't around during the dinosaurs, but I'm just saying, what if? This could have been brought to you by some foreign substances, but funny nonetheless to me.
Yeah, it was just, Perry Saturn was doing some comic relief here, and, you know, probably one of their better, I wouldn't say memorable, but probably one of their better promos as a collective.
Sure. Then we go to the filthy animals with Gene Okerlund, our other backstage interviewer, and Conan asks Okerlund, hat or the title? And Okerlund says, the hat. All right, go. So Okerlund feels his fuzzy hat, and then Conan cuts him off by saying, that's enough.
That's weird. You can touch two things on my body.
One of two.
Oh, one of two.
The title or the fuzzy hat.
Yeah.
Tori is interviewed because she's part of this mixed tag elimination match and says, I'm not afraid to fight those half pints, as she towers over Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio, as this woman is in heels here,
yeah,
over top these two.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of strange that she's not afraid to fight those half pints, Perry Saturn and Dean Malenko. Disco is then with Tony Marinara apologizing, and Tony gets up looking very upset and says, tomorrow night, the boys are coming to Nitro. And this would lead to the debut of Johnny the Bull and Big Vito as the Mamalukes.
Right.
Jeff Jarrett is with Creative Control, and this is a whole segment where they wander into the back with a 2x4 and just walk past the camera. Next up was the elimination match. It was Dean Malenko, Perry Saturn, and Asia against Eddie Guerrero, Billy Kidman, and Tori Wilson with elimination-style rules, which would have been great if the guy that was in charge of the theme music was aware this was an elimination match. Mm-hmm. He had no idea what was going on and how this match ended. Shane Douglas is on commentary. Kidman leaps up for this elbow drop to Perry Saturn. It's mistimed, and he has to reset right away. Kidman would hit a cross body to the floor onto Saturn, and then Malenko gets into it at ringside with this fan dressed up in Canadian face paint with a flag that would later play into something that I don't know there was much point to, but nonetheless, it was telegraphing something. Asia came in and clotheslined Kidman. So who makes the save but Tori, who fights off Asia to protect Billy Kidman. And Tori then injures her ankle and starts selling it in the corner. Dean Malenko rolls up Kidman, who's distracted with Tori's injury, and eliminates Kidman at 2:55, and they start playing the Revolution's theme music and then immediately cut it off, thinking that this was one fall to a finish. Eddie and Kidman are then arguing. This leads to a big Eddie chant, and Conan makes his way over to the corner and starts massaging Tori's ankle. He was aggressively massaging this ankle to make sure it wasn't broken. Then Conan goes to the back. Unexplained.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
Yeah, he was watching the match and then he thought, that's enough. Asia then hits a delay.
I do understand in that they want to leave Tori out there alone at the end, but he didn't really have a reason to leave at that point.
Why was he leaving his teammates?
Yeah.
I guess he just...
to get some oil.
Maybe. Asia hits a delayed vertical suplex to Eddie, and Shivani acknowledges that the crowd is applauding Asia here, who's overcoming these male counterparts.
Yeah. They certainly weren't afraid of, you know, treating Asia like just basically beating her up. Because they certainly did beat her up.
Like, they really had the men just beat the shit out of
her.
That
was the first move that the babyfaces did in this match. Billy Kidman, and Eddie here runs to the ring. First thing they do, double clothesline, double team on a woman.
Eddie pins Dean Malenko at about 5 minutes with a cradle. Saturn and Asia are then working over Eddie, with Asia on lots of offense here. Eddie then ducks, and Saturn super kicks Asia by mistake. Saturn gets back body dropped to the floor, and then Eddie hits a frog splash to Asia to eliminate her at 6:28. Now they play the Filthy Animals music. Oh, but man. No, the match still is going on. Saturn is in, hits a DVD, and now Shane is outraged here at this slow count of Charles Robinson. He gets up and is complaining. Saturn then misses a top rope elbow, and Eddie, the babyface, gets out of the way and tries to go tag in the injured Torrie Wilson to fight Perry Saturn.
But I believe he's supposed to be like somebody who is on his way to turning.
I guess so. What a cowardly move here.
Yeah.
And Shane calls him a coward. Shane also being a heel at the time.
Yeah.
I was so confused. So Saturn then reverses a cross body and applies the Rings of Saturn to eliminate Eddie. They assume the match is over, but no, Torrie Wilson is left with Perry Saturn. Torrie hits Saturn with a low blow and gets a near fall. Then Shane Douglas gets onto the apron and is distracting the referee. So behind the referee's back, Saturn hits Torrie Wilson with a low blow and pins her at 11 minutes and 15 seconds. What a bizarre match.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that would hurt, too. Just a kick to the ovaries.
Female fighters have said that it hurts.
Yeah, I imagine it does.
So Saturn was clearly aware of this.
There you go.
And won through nefarious means.
Yeah, I think in concept it was a good idea. Basically, you know, to tease that, oh, there's a possibility that this woman, Torrie, could be left alone with one of these guys with nobody to defend her. At the end it was okay. I thought it wasn't bad. I thought, you know, some fun stuff here. I think it's always a pleasure to watch Eddie in there, especially against guys like Dean and Perry.
I think Eddie, he was also very banged up at this point. He came back so quickly after that car wreck he had on New Year's Eve the prior year, and you know, from all accounts, he was going through a very, very rough period at this point in terms of, you know, his alcohol and drug use at the time. But, I mean, a tremendously gifted performer, which we're not alerting anybody to that isn't aware. They immediately cut to Jarrett and Creative Control. They have attacked Buff Bagwell in the locker room. And coming away, Bobby Heenan calls this the greatest pay-per-view ever.
Yeah.
Okay. Greatest. Fans been to WrestleManias,
no,
Starcades, no, Mayhem.
Subjective.
I guess so. Yeah. And we're not even halfway through the show yet. Up next was Kurt Hennig against Buff Bagwell in a loser hangs up their boots match, which was designed to be a retirement match, not a loser literally putting their boots up.
Uh-huh.
Which I always thought was maybe that was an inside joke on Kurt Hennig, because there's a famous story involving Dynamite Kid and Jacques Rougeau, where someone apparently got into Jacques Rougeau's gear and fucked it up and hung it above in the locker room. And it was Kurt Hennig who fucked with all of it, but Tom Billington got accused for it by Jacques Rougeau, and it led to a big fight between Rougeau and Billington, and it was Kurt Hennig who was the mastermind behind it. And I think he hung his Jacques Rougeau's boots up as well and cut up his ring gear. Anyway, basically, this angle with Hennig was with the new powers that be. They did the Ric Flair angle here, where if Kurt Hennig had his shoulders pinned to the mat, he would be forced to retire. So he had to win his matches. He had to win his matches to a degree, because they showed this video where he would either escape with a win, then they booked him against Bill Goldberg on TV where he submitted, but they explained he has to be pinned to lose his job.
Uh-huh.
Why do you need these complications to things? Like, we take such a fucking basic idea and, oh no, if he submitted, he doesn't lose his job. He's got to be pinned.
Why wouldn't he just submit every single
time? Look, what a stupid idea.
Yeah.
But well, we had to put him in a match where he loses by submission?
Yeah. Well, I even put him against Bill Goldberg.
That match didn't need to be booked.
No.
Put him in a match where he wins.
You just want to be clever, I suppose.
Well, this match would be very interesting. Jarrett and Creative Control come out instead of Buff Bagwell. So they're teasing that Bagwell's been hurt and can't fight. And they start attacking Kurt Hennig. Bagwell then runs out, chases them off with the 2x4, and then Hennig attacks Bagwell from behind. So this was very confusing, because Buff Bagwell was a babyface at the time who was not favored by the powers that be. And
so neither of these men were?
No, yeah. Neither guy was.
That's all. Thus putting the two of them in a loser leaves town match. They win
this
no matter what.
I guess so. But it was, it wasn't clear to me if it was just Hennig's job that was on the line,
right?
Or if it was Bagwell's,
right?
Like they identified it as loser hangs up their boots, but it was the storyline was Hennig had to keep winning. So yeah, I didn't even get that part clear. Bagwell's job was on the line here. They fought on the floor. Hennig got rammed back first into the apron, and then right in front of Nick Patrick, Hennig just fucking soccer kicks him right in the balls.
Yeah.
It just keeps going. Hennig was the babyface to the crowd here, even though he was working a heel-style match. But the crowd, I mean, this was like the legend that was fighting for his job. What did you expect the crowd to react to here against the pretty boy Buff Bagwell?
And there are certain characters like, you know, like WWF characters of the late or early 90s. Like
there's a nostalgia, especially in a market like Toronto that's very entrenched with WWF.
Yeah, guys like Mr. Perfect, guys like, you know, Scott Hall, Diesel.
Yep.
Those guys will always get cheered and applauded.
So the crowd was out of it for most of this match. Bagwell hit the blockbuster just out of nowhere. I mean, it wasn't really built up. Mm-hmm. Pins Hennig at 7:43 and then starts gloating to the camera. And then we got the most insincere selling by Bobby Heenan.
Bob Bagwell has won the match, and Kurt Hennig must hang up his boots.
No, Tony, no. I can't believe I witnessed this. I cannot believe this.
Take a long look, man. In the ring as Buff Bagwell walks out, trying to get to his feet.
I don't want to even talk about this. This is a sad day. This is a sad day for our business.
Who, after this alleged retirement now that Hennig has been forced into, Heenan says, no, no, I cannot believe this, Tony. This is a sad day for our business. And the Toronto crowd, they tried to make this such an important moment. They gave him a standing ovation. And I will tell you, Wei, leaving the building that night, Hennig was, at worst, the number three babyface on this show, if not number two, ahead of Benoit. He was so loved by this crowd that he felt like that was a big deal. And then the next night, he was hired back as one of the members of the powers that be
in a suit.
Awesome. Like, they did no work to create this guy. It was all the crowd that gave this guy a lease on his career, and they fucked it up. But this guy, leaving the arena that night, if you ask people, what do you remember of Mayhem, if you attended it live, it was Kurt Hennig and the tease that he was forced to retire.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Like I said, everybody has such fond memories of that Mr. Perfect character. And, I mean, you see his reaction to him, and you see, like, he could still go even at this time, even all the way up until he came back to the WWE. I thought he was good here.
He had his moments.
I thought he was good. But you see this and you wonder, why didn't this guy have more classic matches over in the 90s? Why didn't this guy do more with his career than he had?
He was a guy much like Bam Bam Bigelow. I think by the time they got to WCW, I just felt like I don't know if it was just not motivated, just, you know, the environment. I just saw this guy who was just like, it just felt it had been beaten out of him, and he was just collecting a paycheck at this point. But man, you had this moment where, and even during the standing ovation, they acknowledge it's a standing ovation, and they just cut right to the back.
Oh,
let this breathe for a minute. You got a great moment here.
That was the thing with this entire show. They had 12 matches on the show. They had no time. They left no time in between for things to digest.
Like, leave yourself some buffer room for something like this that happens. Stay on the crowd. Like, and this would have been more remembered than about anything on this show.
And then all these backstage vignettes that were pretty meaningless of guys just, like, showing up to the arena, like, great, who cares? Kimberly walks into the back. Great, thank you. Unnecessary.
Mike Tenay interviewed Sting. He says he would have still been champion if it wasn't for the powers that be, just completely negating the fact that he was pinned by Goldberg the prior month. But up next was Bret Hart and Sting, semifinals of the tournament.
Man, Bret had an awful theme song.
That was my first note here, because I don't think anyone knew that was Bret Hart's theme music until there was no reaction till he walked out.
Yeah.
And this crowd, from the start of this pay-per-view, were going nuts for Bret. Yeah. And it wasn't until he walked out that this is Bret's music.
Everybody obviously expecting to hear the Bret Hart theme song with the guitar and everything. Like, this thing in WCW he had was the most generic
It sucked.
Oh, nothing.
And like, it's like, I'm not a big fan of when TNA takes a guy and they modify his WWE theme. It does look low rent, but at the same time, there's also that idea that a lot of your audience, they respond to that.
Absolutely.
Like, WCW, it would have been to their benefit to at least kick it off with, like, the big riff off the top that was so synonymous.
Something similar, because, you know, like, American Made is no, you know, real American. But it achieves the same thing. It has the same result. It sounds enough like it that, you know, when that song hits, oh, UK, this sounds like a Hulk Hogan type of theme, and, you know, people are going to pop for it. This Bret Hart thing has nothing that resembles anything about the character or anything that'll clue you in into that this guy is even a big star.
Bret came out with a Wayne Gretzky Team Canada hockey jersey on. Sting, wrestling in a t-shirt all the way back in 1999. And he looked in fine shape here in 1999.
Yeah.
Very conscious. They fought by the announce table, then got back into the ring. The announcers did a good job here in terms of playing up the fact that, you know, both guys with the same finisher,
yep,
and trying to tell that aspect of the story.
Sting here, this was a rare occasion of seeing Sting wrestle heel because, you know, he was going up against Bret.
Yeah, they had tried to turn Sting heel a few months prior. It didn't work at all, and then pretty much flipped them back to the babyface role. But on this night, he was clearly going to be taken as the heel here in Toronto. Sting got the advantage. He sent Hart to the floor into the announce desk, goes for a running splash, and Hart gets out of the way, so Sting lands on the desk, and then Hart gets Irish whipped into the barricade. At one point, the referee, Mickey J, gets knocked down, and this leads to Lex Luger, I'm sorry, the total package, and Elizabeth coming down. He gets a baseball bat, and he takes out Sting. And this, of course, gets a babyface pop because he's helping the hero, Bret Hart. Hart then takes the bat, and he puts Luger in the sharpshooter. Mickey J calls for the bell at 7 minutes and 34 seconds and awards Bret Hart the win by disqualification.
And then?
Hart requests that the match continue, and Mickey J says, yeah, okay, sounds good. So they restart the match.
What the fuck was the point of that entire
thing? The point, I suppose,
is to make Bret seem like, oh, what a good guy, he doesn't want to win by DQ. But they rushed through this so that it was like, you're DQ'd. And then 3 seconds later, somehow Bret whispers in his ear, oh, okay, I changed my mind. Oh, this match was restarted.
The only thing I took from this was that, okay, Sting's going to face Lex Luger at the next pay-per-view. We'll do this angle tomorrow night. Like, there was just such an adversity to just throwing out a clean match.
Yeah.
And it's such a broken record at this point. But it was just, anyway, they went another minute and 47 seconds where Sting applied the Scorpion Deathlock, Hart countered it into the sharpshooter.
It was
fine
cool.
Finish.
This was really cool.
Yeah.
It was just basically the guy stayed in the same locked position, but one of them just stood up while the other fell on his stomach, and that was the reversal, and I thought it was really great.
So Bret gets the clean win, they have a stare down after the match, and they shake hands to try and, you know, babyface Sting, which the crowd applauded.
Heenan calls this the best win of Bret Hart's career. The best win of his career, a semifinal in a tournament.
Yeah. Gene Okerlund is with Chris Benoit. He says he considers it an honor to face Bret Hart in Canada. The last time they did it in honor of Owen, referencing the match on Nitro in Kansas City, which I will add, just as a distinct note here, went about 30 minutes on television through numerous commercial breaks. There were no run-ins. There were no storytelling. There was no baseball bats. We had a clean finish, and the rating grew over 30 minutes. What a shocking concept.
But that's a special case, though. That there's a lot more story, actually, and a lot more real-life ramifications.
Just, there was an idea that, at that time, that no one is going to stay tuned to a match that long on television. We have to do matches in three minutes or less.
Right.
And, you know, there's no hard and fast rule when it comes to stuff like that, in my opinion.
Yeah. But, I don't know. That's sort of a special case, but, yeah.
Mike Tenay is with Luger and Elizabeth. He is now in a neck brace from this baseball bat attack. He calls it carelessness from Bret Hart with the bat. I wouldn't say carelessness. He absolutely wanted to hit him with a bat. So, and says he cannot compete tonight, unfortunately, and he's going to write a personal check to every single fan to get their money's worth tonight. I didn't pay for my ticket, so that would have been a unique situation. I wonder what would have happened there.
But you wanted to see Lex Luger,
yeah,
obviously.
I don't know if he would have been able to write a check to everybody. Vampiro was up next. This was when the Misfits were part of WCW, as he was accompanied by Jerry Only to take on Berlin.
Like the real Jerry Only. Well, like, we're not talking some dude dressed as the Kiss demon here. This is the actual bassist from the Misfits in a wrestling match.
To take on Berlin, who I enjoyed the guy's theme music. He had theme music that in WCW was different.
I thought he had a cool look. I thought the whole package was cool, but it's just, I don't know.
They came up with all these vignettes for him, a lot of which didn't air because they thought it was a little too...
too much.
A little too much. This kind of, you know, they were really treading on this kind of character, like that he was almost like this neo-Nazi.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, TBS, Time Warner, they weren't exactly ecstatic about this character. But apparently, this was supposed to be Vampiro against Berlin during a chain match. I literally
That's what I thought.
Then I saw Vampiro against the wall. We saw Berlin against Jerry Only. Then it became Vampiro and Berlin. Well, did a bell ring here.
I'm glad you noticed it because the...
I was so confused.
Because the announcers certainly were not paying attention at all when any of this was happening.
I don't think they knew. We had Ed Ferrara come out as Oklahoma alongside Dr. Death Steve Williams. This was after they had debuted the Oklahoma character, parodying Jim Ross right down to the Bell's palsy. And he did commentary for this match.
Yeah, and explain Dr. Death's involvement. Because, I mean, Dr. Death, Steve Williams, a personal friend of Jim Ross's, obviously, you know, what was his whole, you know,
well, this was during a time when Jim Ross and Dr. Death were not on good terms. Because Dr. Death, of course, he had, you know, had come out of Oklahoma University, had his, you know, huge run in All Japan Pro Wrestling, and was still doing All Japan at a time when the WWF, they were looking at, you know, getting some heels for Steve Austin. And the idea was they get Dr. Death to come in largely at the urging of Jim Ross, who kind of brokered that deal together. He was the head of talent relations at the time. They brought in Dr. Death, based the Brawl for All around, this would be a great introduction for this guy. Everyone felt, you know, this guy will run through everybody, as some kind of legitimacy, and then boom, we're off to the races, can have a big program with Austin. Of course, we all know how the Brawl for All panned out. Dr. Death did not win. As he put it, tore his ass muscle when he fought Bart Gunn. And then they really didn't have much for Dr. Death after that point. He kind of just fizzled out. He was not, I mean, he had taken a lot of wear and tear doing that Japanese style for so long that he really wasn't at his physical peak at this point by the time he got to the WWF. And then he was released. And I think there was a lot of ill will towards Jim Ross at the time, that Ross wasn't able to keep him around or put him in some kind of program. And so when the offer came to come do WCW, I think that A, it was a paycheck, and B, it was also the idea that, you know, he was just kind of fine at this point of, you know, doing something to kind of stick it back at Jim Ross. And
really, they
would hash things out afterwards, and I think Dr. Death was really apologetic about it. But Dr. Death would also continue with All Japan after WCW, which was in 2000 when you had the whole exodus over from All Japan to Noah, and he always remained loyal to All Japan at that time when everyone else was leaving. It was like him and like Taue and Kawada that stuck around with All Japan. Anyway.
So Taue left too.
Taue would eventually leave. I think at the time though. Yeah, anyway, that's a WH one. But Kawada certainly stayed, and I don't know if Taue at first was one of the ones to stay. Anyway, we're getting off topic. But that was how Dr. Death ended up here in WCW. And this was really, you know, just, you know, Russo and Ross had a long history of just being on completely different pages. Today, Russo will say much different, as will Ferrara. I think they've kind of... don't hold that resentment, but they were definitely at opposing ends in the WWF, and this was their way of kind of just mocking Jim Ross openly on now that they had this outlet in WCW to throw out characters like Oklahoma.
He was so annoying in this match. He steps in on commentary, and from the first moments of this match, basically the announcers, Shivani and Heenan, completely ignore everything that's going on. They missed okay, like you mentioned, Berlin, Charles Robinson is the referee. He ties up Vampiro and then goes to tie up Berlin with the chain. Berlin just tosses the chain down and then beats out and knocks out Charles Robinson. And then now the whole match is just becomes, what, a tag team match? The announcers miss all of this. Meanwhile, there's a replacement ref in the ring. It's now Nick Patrick. And now it's the wall in there. Instead of Berlin, it's the wall that's now chained to Vampiro, and the referee looks on like this is all normal and continues.
Yeah, some of what we heard from Oklahoma, I mean, Jim Ross was always famous for, you know, giving guys, you know, athletic backgrounds, so we had him mocking the, you know, Berlin competed in the Sauerkraut Bowl. Berlin reminds him of a young Danny Hodge. Berlin gets upset at the wall. And just, this was just so confusing here as they went back and forth. Schiavone yells out, Berlin is leaving, and then has to be corrected that it's the wall that is leaving. I don't think he even had the characters straight here. So anyway, it led to Vampiro and Jerry only double-teaming the heel, Berlin, and then applying a camel clutch with the chain, Vampiro does, and Berlin submits. They never rung the bell to start this match. It went about 4 minutes from the first interaction. This sucked. This was just terrible.
This was complete garbage.
And then Dr. Death attacked Vampiro, hit him with an overhead suplex, slammed Jerry only into the corner, and then onto the mat, hit a doctor bomb to Vampiro. And I believe at this point Vampiro was very vocal about how Dr. Death just like threw these guys around. Like it was like some reckless throws here.
With one of them being Jerry Only, who's not even a pro wrestler.
Yeah.
Like, what was the deal with him? Because,
I mean, I will
say he didn't look out of place here. Like, he was
he fit Vampiro's group at the time. And I think that was a deal Vampiro just had with the Misfits and was able to broker on his own.
For somebody who is not a wrestler, like, he took some big bumps here and didn't look that bad taking them.
They cut away here. Another famous WWE cutaway is Dr. Death got onto the turnbuckles, and like he was Steve Austin, he was like signaling for the beer, and I think they threw him the barbecue sauce, and he then poured it on himself.
That's funny.
But they had cut away from this, so this didn't make the broadcast. Mike Tenay is with...
See, like, nothing is impactful at all. Like, there's no...
No, and that's...
This Dr. Death thing was supposed to have been probably what you come out of this match remembering, but...
TNA used to be terrible at this, where nothing would sink in because everything was like, cut away, next, next, next. Yeah. It was like, just let us breathe and take in what's happening here.
Yeah.
And that was never in their mindset. Mike Tenay was with Scott Hall, and... Rick Steiner had injured himself. He had to forfeit his match with Scott Hall and therefore forfeit the television title. So now Scott Hall is the U.S. and television champion and has given an open challenge to the locker room. And that was going to be our match tonight, a mystery opponent. Scott Hall looked like he was Scott Hall of 1999 in this promo.
Yeah, oh, is that right?
Yeah, he looked...
I don't know.
Anyway, I don't want to...
Oh, he looked way better than he would later on.
Later on. Though today, Scott Hall has made a remarkable turnaround.
Yes.
I mean, from those that see him at these conventions now, he apparently has really turned things around, so good for him. Kurt Hennig is leaving the arena as Schiavone has to fax away any remaining credibility by saying, this is the last time we will ever see him until Nitro tomorrow. And the talent is saying goodbye to him. Kimberly arrives at the building a good 20 minutes before her match. Very cold out at this point in November in Toronto, and she was wearing very little on top. Guess, you know.
She probably doesn't own a jacket where she's from.
The total package comes out in his neck brace and explains he's been forced to compete tonight. By who? The powers that be?
Yeah, I'd assume.
All right. They show footage of Luger attacking Ming on television with a bat. And then Ming would help Sting beat Luger in the tournament. So now we've got the total package against Ming. Luger fights with the neck brace on, and Luger is stomping him as they re-enter the ring. Ming applies a choke into the corner on the neck brace.
Tongan death grip.
Yeah. So this was great, because Tony Schiavone is explaining that it has no effect because he's got the neck brace on, yet Luger is selling it. Ming then no-sells these headshots into the turnbuckle, and then he repeatedly rams his own head into the turnbuckle. Samoans do not feel head trauma, is what we're supposed... That's, I guarantee you wrestling fans...
That's science.
...still believe that to this day. And then headbutts Luger. Crowd was dead for this. Elizabeth, the two are tied up in the ropes. Luger's face is on the second rope. And then Elizabeth struggles to take out, like, some perfume shit. And It was mace, all right? And goes to spray it and has an awful time doing it. Like, Luger is, like, plain as day right in front of her. And then she sprays Luger in the eyes. I was confused here. The announcers are explaining she was going for Ming, but then Ming pulled a fast one, which did not jive with what I was watching.
It was not fast at all. It looked like she was aiming directly for Luger.
And then Ming applies the Tongan death grip and pins him at 524. Another terrible match.
A really boring, brawling match, mainly consisting of kicks and stomps.
Like, no need for this.
No, this sucked.
Okerlund's with Bret Hart. They tee up the finals. Bret says he's going to put his friendship with Chris Benoit aside. And then just randomly here during this promo, Lex Luger wanders by, looking all bent out of shape. Yeah. Like, they didn't acknowledge it. It looked like it was an honest mistake. David Flair, in a very suggestive cutaway, is polishing his crowbar, which reads about as dirty as it appeared here.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Hall comes out. He says Kevin Nash is on his way, and they're going to turn Toronto upside down, and then challenges anyone in the back. Harlem Heat's music starts, then it stops, and then it starts again as Booker T comes out. So Hall is mocking him at the start of the match, slapping him around.
Hall basically was made himself a baby face here.
And Booker looked like a dork here.
Booker was the heel. Yeah.
There's a choke slam by Scott Hall for a two count. The crowd was much more into Scott Hall. He catches Booker, hits him with a fall-away slam. Crowd goes nuts for that spot. Then clearly there was either a fight in the crowd or some girl was flashing the crowd because they were completely distracted here as Hall applied a sleeper hold. Jarrett and Creative Control came out. Booker T hits an axe kick and then a Harlem sidekick. Jarrett distracts the referee. Creative Control goes after Booker. They explain Stevie Ray is suspended and why he's not out here. So Booker goes into the corner for Jarrett, and then as he's got his back turned, Scott Hall hits the outsider edge and pins Booker at 6 minutes and 4 seconds. So Scott Hall, the heel face, gets the win, and then Jarrett and Creative Control attack Booker T after the match. The lights go out, and Midnight appears in the ring, who was... Asia was the knockoff of China, and Midnight was the knockoff of Asia. And this was all for the tagline, "You never know when Midnight will strike."
Mm-hmm.
And it struck Midnight here at roughly 10 p.m. Eastern in Toronto.
It's good, a good idea to do the Taker thing with her. Midnight. Oh, it's dark.
Yeah, it's dark.
Because she's black.
Yeah. So Booker and Midnight clear the ring. Luger is wandering into the back looking for Elizabeth. Cannot find her. Shivani and Heenan are back on camera, so we got to see the fan behind them again making faces. And then we got, what a video here on the climax to this Kimberly Page-David Flair feud.
Was this the birth of the psycho David Flair character?
This was the beginning of the psycho character. We had Kimberly trying to seduce David Flair, which was a plot to drug him in a hotel room. And then it turned out Ric Flair was in the hotel room and then allegedly grabbed Kimberly's ass 14 times. DDP then fights Ric Flair at Halloween Havoc, and it features DDP going up and making out with David Flair. He grabbed him and kissed him on the lips.
He wasn't making out.
It was a long kiss.
Yeah, it was just one of those, like kiss of death type of things.
Oh, okay. David Flair then takes him out with a crowbar, and then with DDP out hurt, he starts stalking Kimberly. This featured Kimberly running backstage to a security guard who then, with his back to Kimberly, who turns around, takes off his hat, and it's David Flair.
Yeah. Ooh. I hate it when that happens.
And then David Flair shows up in a shower, promising to give Kimberly more than a spanking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that would imply.
Well, whatever. But I would say this David Flair was a real improvement over what he was before.
Oh, this was a much different character.
Much different, yeah. And I mean, I don't think he did a bad job with it. I thought this definitely... It was something different than simply being Rick Jr., which he had no capability of pulling off.
The the babyface pseudo rapist. It's never been done in wrestling before.
It hasn't?
Not to my knowledge.
I mean, what about, like, I feel like it's been done so often. Like, what about, like, Brian Pillman?
He was a heel at the time with Marlena.
Okay.
So David Flair comes out. His eyes are, like, all done up to emphasize this man hasn't slept in, like, months. Mm-hmm. They're all purple. Look like CM Punk. Crowd is going insane here for Kimberly as she comes out wearing wearing this top that was barely passable, even for pay-per-view, I would say, and then got over by stretching and the crowd trying to see down her top. Yeah. Am I accurate in this assessment?
Well, you were there live. You got a up-close view of it.
Well, if you noticed here, she wasn't really in our area, so it was harder to see. But this crowd,
Were you camera side?
Like, we were like just to the left of the camera side.
Oh,
so opposite the hard camera.
Could you see yourself in this?
No. We were like on the side where they were shooting.
No. I gotcha.
Anyway, so. Listen, of all the matches, the crowd was, like, super into this match because of the idea that they would either see boobs or a potential sexual act on a pay-per-view.
This is something that's easy to understand.
The crowd is, they're going nuts here, and Kimberly goes up to David Flair and then kicks him low, and then David no-sells it, takes a crowbar from the corner, and then starts punching his balls. And then takes the crowbar and takes out Nick Patrick with the crowbar. And
to signify that he's wearing a cup.
Or that he doesn't have feeling in his balls.
That too? That's possible.
So Kimberly is all scared here, and she gets on her knees. And the crowd is excited as David lifts the crowbar. I don't know what the crowd was excited for here. Like,
no,
that this
woman.
Man was going to attack a woman with a metal object? That's pretty fucked.
There's a lot of tension here. Either a man will be beating
Well, the physical tension turned into sexual tension.
Well, yeah, and so she decides to seduce him.
This got so creepy, because then Kimberly, to try and ward off this psychopath, started to undo his pants.
Yep.
This crowd was thinking blowjob. But instead, it was a screw job because she grabbed his cup and then beat him with his own cup.
Yeah, wow.
And then stuffed the jock strap into his face as she leaned over. And the crowd got very excited as Kimberly then mounted David and started slapping him.
Mm-hmm.
So the crowd was loving this. Chris Kanyon then
What was your reaction live?
We didn't really have a good view of this because people in all the rows were standing up.
Oh.
It's one of those moments. I remember where there was a WWF show once where I went with my friends to watch it. And my brother, he went with my dad. And this was like you watching with your dad, but times 10. Because they did a deal with DX where they got some girl to come into the ring and tried to get her to flash the crowd. And I just remember thinking there, I'm so glad I'm not my brother with my dad right now. Like, I couldn't explain this. And I just remember thinking here, I was like, I'm glad I'm not here with, like, my dad. Because I wouldn't be able to explain this woman who's teasing a blowjob inside of a wrestling ring right now.
Yeah.
What did you think watching this? Had you ever seen this match before?
I had not.
What did you think?
What did I think? I thought, wow, certainly we've come a long way since then. We don't really do anything like this anymore in pro wrestling. But back then, the crowd wanted to see a blowjob in the ring.
Chris Kanyon makes his long-awaited return to WCW programming as Tony Schiavone's yelling, he's been off in Hollywood doing a WCW production. It's called Ready to Rumble.
He likes just saying all this. He's in such shock, yet he still has the composure to say all this.
To plug what he was doing. Then DDP shows up back from the dead as he's still, like, holding his ribs as if he was just attacked not a month ago, but just moments ago. He's like still selling like rib shots from 4 weeks ago. And he hits David with a diamond cutter after Canyon was fighting him off. Yeah. Then Arn Anderson runs in to take the crowbar away from DDP to save David. And then David from behind attacks Arn with the crowbar. And it leaves the and just leaves through the crowd.
Oh, what a mess.
Arn is then taken out on a stretcher. The crowd, I'm sorry, didn't give a shit about Arn Anderson being stretchered out. And Arn did a great job selling death here. But this crowd, you could hear the chance of take it off during this long stretcher job where someone in the crowd was clearly going to take what Kimberly teased to actuality.
Of course. I mean, like,
this was a sad stretcher job where no one was feeling for poor Arn Anderson.
They rushed to this. They were trying to treat this like it was some big deal, but I mean, you just had three returns all at the same time within seconds of each other, and then how many turns? Like, you had David turn on Arn, then you had, it was just very poorly handled, and to try to expect any type of dramatic emotion to come out of this is ridiculous.
The show would continue, and it would... I thought we'd hit the low point of this show, but you know what? WCW, if nothing else, these motherfuckers could outdo themselves. Mike Tenay is with Sid Vicious, and he asks if anyone... Sid asks if anyone can conceive the words "I quit" coming out of my mouth. I can, you just said it. It just came out of your mouth. And basically, they were playing off their match from Halloween Havoc, and he says he's going to tear every muscle and shred the skin of Bill Goldberg. Now, on paper, you hear Bill Goldberg, Sid Vicious, and you think, my God, these two had a really good match at Halloween Havoc. Like, by their standards, like, this match shocked the hell out of me at the time. Mm-hmm. So this was actually one of the more anticipated matches on this pay-per-view for myself, because I saw what they did at Halloween Havoc. The follow-up, though, an I Quit match. They fought on the floor at the start of the match, and why these two were in an I Quit match when neither has exactly a heavy artillery of submissions in their back drawer, I don't know. But I guess it was the only logical follow-up to their match from the prior month.
It wasn't a submission match.
Well, an I Quit match, I think you kind of... if you're going to have a five-minute fucking match, you're not... I don't know. I don't know what the point of this was. Anyway, they get into the ring. Sid applies a Cobra Clutch and then a choke slam. Hits a second choke slam. Goldberg then counters...
He was like the third guy to do a choke slam in this past hour on the
show.
Yeah,
Scott Hall was doing them for no reason. It really kind of lost its oomph. Goldberg then counters and tries for an armbar, where his armbar consisted of him pulling Sid's arm, like, no attention to technique at all. Like, this was him, like, pushing the ribs with his foot, and the chance of Goldberg sucks were very, very evident here. And I think a lot of people, Sid definitely had something where they were in, like, some of these Northeast, and I think Toronto by extension was like that.
I mean, it's again
where
that
they took to Sid, and Goldberg was presented as a heel the last time they were in Toronto, where they did that famous angle with Bret Hart pinning him.
Right.
So they did not care for Goldberg here. And then Goldberg applies this weird submission where he grabs, like, the wrist from behind.
It was a Cobra Clutch.
Maybe yeah, that was the idea.
That's what he was going for.
This looked terrible.
It was loose.
And then he went to his back, and then this was the finish. 5 minutes and 32 seconds. This was such a flat finish to me.
Because, I mean, Goldberg's probably never used that submission before, so it wasn't an over-submission. And the controversy is that he made Sid pass out, and so Sid never gave up.
Yeah, the announcers were way too heavy-handed.
So then who was the babyface here?
They were trying to make Sid a babyface here.
Okay.
Without turning Goldberg heel.
Just in this town?
I think they wanted to turn Sid babyface regardless.
Oh, I see. So they wanted to do the Austin and Bret
They wanted
finish.
To do the Austin thing. I believe Russo said later that they were not allowed to do more blood because of the last pay-per-view.
Oh, blood would not have helped.
Like, that's it to me. It's like, you know what? Competent workers can get a story across without relying on blood, much like a great promo man can get a great promo across without swearing. Like, that to me is such a shitty argument. But you want to get this big story across in 5 minutes with guys that are not exactly regarded as the industry's greatest storytellers.
Yeah.
Like, know your limits here and know what you're dealing with. And don't blame on the fact that these guys couldn't bleed in this match.
It just makes me laugh to think that that's what they're going for with this set of limitations.
Yeah. Okerlund is in the back. They just cut away from this. This was such a... And if nothing else, a letdown. Because the prior... Watch that Halloween Havoc match, and those two got way more out of what you would expect from a Bill Goldberg-Sid match in 1999. Okerlund's with Luger, who says, "Your plans literally backfired," which is not true. Not accurate use of the word literally. There was no explosion.
There's no fire.
Nothing. And... basically, this was teasing some turn of his on Elizabeth, which would end up being a swerve on Sting. And Elizabeth has disappeared. Luger says she screwed up, but he doesn't get mad. He gets even. And she better watch her back. Chris Benoit, Bret Hart, the finals of this mayhem pay-per-view for the WCW title. They shake hands to start the match.
Were you surprised at that point to see Benoit in the main event?
A little bit. That was the one everyone figured that Brett was definitely going to the finals.
Mm-hmm.
But they were really pushing it hard that, you know, the A storyline was like this powers that be deal and having Jarrett involved.
Mm-hmm.
So I was somewhat surprised they went with Benoit in the finals. I think it surprised a lot of people. Hart goes for the sharpshooter very early on, but Benoit counters. He's going for the crossface as Hart makes the ropes. Then some fan hops the rail dressed as the Canadian fan from earlier with the face paint and the Canadian jersey on and attacks Benoit, and they explain it's Dean Malenko.
Mm-hmm. What a swerve. The guy he attacked earlier.
So Dean went after this fan and then inherited his costume.
Yeah.
So we don't know who the original fan was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea I had heard at the time...
Maybe it was Brett.
Yeah.
Or wait, maybe it was Benoit, sorry, because Benoit was in the Revolution.
No, he had been turned on by the Revolution.
Okay, so it was Brett then.
Yeah, and who knows? Anyway, there was an idea at the time of doing some angle on this pay-per-view where the Revolution was going to burn the American flag or a Canadian flag, and it got nixed. And they were told, no, you are not burning any flags.
Why would they burn the? You mean they would have burned the Canadian flag? No, why would they burn the American flag?
Their idea was, you know, they're the Revolution, and they are going to be, essentially, they are starting their own nation.
Their own country?
Yeah. And they're going to burn down the states. So
who would have been president? Eddie or Dean?
Shane.
Shane would have been president. Right, okay.
Yeah, of course.
Gotcha.
Why we needed a Dean Malenko attack on Benoit in this particular match, I don't quite know.
It made no difference.
He was just taken to the back, ineffective run-in.
All that...
No, and wasn't even the only run-in of the match.
All that face paint, I mean...
What a waste.
What a waste.
Brett hit a pile driver to Benoit, got a two count. Benoit later got on offense, including lifting and hitting Hart with a tombstone, bringing out some of his Pegasus Kid offense.
Mm-hmm.
Benoit goes to the top, hits the diving headbutt. But then as he goes for the pinfall, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash run out and pull Charles Robinson out to the floor.
Oh, God.
Why? I don't know. There was a fall-away slam delivered by Hall. Goldberg runs out. He spears Kevin Nash. Then there's a chair shot to Bill Goldberg from behind by Scott Hall. Hart then sends Hall out of the ring. Goldberg fights Hall and Nash, a very unspirited brawl to the back, to the point they just cut away from these three fools. Benoit then is attacking the left leg of Brett. He's selling the left leg. Comes back with a superplex, Russian leg sweep, gets a two count. Then Hart goes for a vertical suplex. Benoit counters, hits his Germans, then into a crossface attempt, which Hart blocks, drops him on his back, and gets the sharpshooter, and Benoit taps out at 17 minutes, 44 seconds. Overbooked when it really didn't need to be. This didn't push much at all. And this was the start of the build to right after Starrcade, where they would bring back the NWO with Brett as one of the key figures, along with Hall, Nash, Jarrett.
Yeah.
So, yeah, make that
Just overbooked to hell, and I still actually found it quite boring despite all that. I mean, by this point, the run-ins were just to be expected. They were like status quo for every match. So
they lost their meaning. It was just, okay, this is the part of the match where someone comes in and...
You had four people running here.
It was just so much to process.
Yeah, this sucked.
And then Brett got... they said his kids are getting in the ring. There were about 15 of them.
Unless
Brett's stories in his book were, went further than just meeting a lot of women. I think there were other kids as well in the ring. His wife Julie was spotted here in the ring. And it was just a quick celebration, some pyro. He hugged Benoit, waved the Canadian flag, and they went off the air. Brett wins his first WCW title in Toronto.
Well, what did you rate it from your live experience and watching it again?
You know, it was a big thing that, you know, Brett won the title. And I think a lot of people, they looked at Brett's run in WCW for these 2 years had been really underwhelming. Mm-hmm. So I think there was that hope, all right, now he's the main guy. I mean, everyone knew. It's like, man, just put this guy. There's so many great matches he could have, and now he's got the title. So I think there was some optimism, and obviously that wouldn't be realized. And who knew that, you know, this guy, we were watching one of this guy's final series of matches at this point in time a month before he would suffer his concussions. So, I mean, there was optimism with Brett winning that I thought, all right, now you've got your main champion, and now you can have... Hopefully this would be something. I think a lot of people were optimistic at this time, just hoping that WCW could get something going. So that was my takeaway. But, you know, watching this event back, it's hard to watch it without knowing what the end result would be. Not a very enjoyable show to go back and watch. I think, you know, you take out the first and last matches. I mean, horrendous pay-per-view.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but that hardcore title match with Norman Smiley and Brian Knobbs was probably one of the more enjoyable matches on this show. So for me, I give this a 4.5 out of 10, 4.5 out of 10.
I'll go 4. I mean, it was a fun live experience, but going back and watching it, I don't know if I'll be ever watching this one again.
Yeah.
So that was Mayhem, everyone. Those were our thoughts. Let's head on over to the message board. We'll get to your feedback before we get on out of here this week. You can always post your feedback each and every week at lawradio.proboards.com. We are also now doing a weekly segment on The Law where you can post questions during the week, and then we will take those questions each Sunday night on The Law. It was a lot of fun starting that segment this past weekend on The Law. So, wait, why don't we start off here with, we'll start with Gaurav from India. This was an average show, although I still feel weird watching Chris Benoit matches. His great technical wrestling in the ring made me forget all the bad stuff he did outside the ring. Brett and Benoit had great chemistry, and I remember them tearing the house down in a tribute match to Owen after Owen had passed away. Goldberg was over huge with the fans, and I remember loving his entrance back when I was a kid in the late 90s. How much smoke from his entrance pyro do you guys think Goldberg must have inhaled during his entire wrestling career? That was crazy. I've had it with the WCW review, guys. More late 90s WWF, please.
Jake from the UK, wow, this is a pretty bad show and a proper head fucking places. It started off and finished pretty well with two solid Chris Benoit matches marred by pointless interference, but the 2 hours in between were a blurry joke. There was so much going on during this show, it was pretty hard to follow, and to be honest, hard to care. Most of the show was laughable, including the garbage hardcore title match, the spot during the Meng Luger match where Liz just straight up sprayed some shit in Luger's face, and that Kimberly Page and David Flair classic, which the crowd was super hot for, as they thought they were going to witness a blowjob on pay-per-view. The main problem with this show was there were about 50 different people and angles featured, and only people in the crowd cared about the only people the crowd cared about were Brett, Benoit, and Goldberg. It's fair to say Russo wanted to cram 10 pounds of shit into a 5-pound bag, and the end result was a confusing mess.
Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. How ironic is it that it took Vince Russo, of all people, to give the traditionalist Bret Hart his first WCW title after a 2-year run that destroyed his credibility? And that's pretty much the problem with this pay-per-view. The whole tournament concept was built around Bret defeating Benoit to establish himself as the star of the promotion, but no one believed that, including Bret, I guess. Too much damage was done to his character to the point that no one cared. I would disagree. I think people were still willing to take Bret Hart. It wasn't like this guy had been... He had not been utilized to his full potential, but he hadn't been buried, I would say. Just not used accurately. About the rest of the card, didn't remember it at all, but a quick look at Wikipedia suggested I shouldn't bother. Goldberg versus Sid in an I Quit match was probably an inside joke about fans ordering the pay-per-view, as anticlimactic a show, supposed to give good vibes, but won't deliver as it can be.
Jordan from Saskatoon. I thought that the Benoit matches were decent and the double sharpshooter spot was cool in the Sting Brett match. The Filthy Animals Revolution match was again okay. Everything else was utter horse shit. The Goldberg match was just plain bad. Same goes for the Kurt Hennig match. The biggest problem I had was the amount of interference that went on. Being born in 96, was this common in this time for wrestling, or was this a trait of Vince Russo as booker?
I
would say more Vince Russo. I mean, I don't know.
What specifically? I mean,
the interference.
Oh, the interference. I mean, it was. Believe me, the overrun-ins was not exclusive to Vince Russo's style of booking, but it was certainly a common crutch if you would go back and see kind of his way of television. I mean, a lot of it would be, you know, they don't want to beat a guy clean, so we'll have a run-in, and it just got to be like. Not impactful, and it just became one of those, you'd groan when you'd see it. It wasn't like the right kind of emotion you want from, you know, a babyface being cheated, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, Robbie in Vancouver has a question for us. Any thoughts, guys, on Chris Benoit's son, David Benoit, trying to pursue a pro wrestling career? He's definitely a guy who would immediately get Michael McGillicuddy'd upon being signed to any organization. Thanks again, and I appreciate all the work you guys do week in and week out. And for a background, David Benoit has been discussed that he is starting to train a lot, apparently working with Harry Smith, and I don't know who else. He is extremely young at this point. I think he's only like 16 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not like this is a topic that is going to be really one that is discussed, I think, for years to come. But, I mean, let's throw it the hypothetical way. This guy maybe really pursues this, mm-hmm. travels to some places, and becomes someone of note. Like, at the end of the day, this guy's created absolutely, he's committed no crime other than being born to somebody, but he is someone that I think is going to have to do 10 times more than some other second generation wrestler because of, unfortunately, the circumstances of his last name.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like, you know, in pro wrestling, it's like being like the son of Hitler or something like that. You know, that name is just, it kind of sends chills up people's spines.
He would never be given that name. There's no way they'd use David Benoit.
But I mean, even simply to walk into a company with a resume that reads, you know, David Benoit, yeah. and his son of Chris Benoit. He, like, absolutely what you said, I hope people don't hold it against him because, if anything, like, he
shouldn't.
Like, he's like, I mean, I feel so bad for his entire family.
That entire family.
To have to, you know,
absolutely.
Suffer the consequences of something one person did. And so I hope people, I mean, if they are interested in him, just judge him based, like, you know, like you would judge anybody else. Is he a good wrestler? If so, then give him a job. If not, then, you know, forget it.
Yeah, in a perfect world, the guy should be judged just as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, you know, if he becomes someone that is worth signing, I think I'd be very uneasy of him going by that last name because that's baggage you don't need.
I would make no association with him at whatsoever in storyline form.
Yeah.
I mean, and if you do, you can, I suppose, because, like, not to say, like, you would be exploiting anything, but, like, I'm sure this guy has had to live through a lot of emotional trauma in the past recent years.
No doubt.
And that could make for something quite compelling just on a emotional human level.
All right. Well, interesting question there from Ravi. So thanks, guys, very much for the feedback. We'll wrap up this week's edition of the show. Now, Wei, is the time that we look ahead to next week and...
More Vince Russo.
Yeah, we're going to be reviewing... No, we'll take a week off.
We'll take your advice. We won't do any WCW from the late 90s.
But much like Vince Russo to many wrestling fans, I feel you and I, we're going to anger a certain segment of our listeners.
Well, damned if we do, damned if we don't.
Yeah. The fact is, folks, it is the 20th anniversary show of the UFC.
Oh, no.
Yep.
Those letters. Ugh.
UFC 167 is coming up this Saturday night. George St. Pierre, Johnny Hendricks, and... the UFC recently put out their 20-year documentary, 20 Years of Fighting. I think it's called Fighting for a Generation is what it's called. So next week, we feel this is a happy medium. And listen, I wanted to review, we've reviewed UFCs 1 and 2. I wanted to review UFC 3.
Review 1?
We've reviewed 2.
Not 1.
No, we've reviewed UFC 1 and UFC 2.
We've done 1 as well?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we did do the 1. So we're going to review the documentary.
I wanted to watch this anyway, and John was just like, hold on a second there.
Well, same with me. And I started watching this, and a minute in, I'm like, wait a minute. I've done this before where I've watched something, and then we want to go review it, and then I got to rewatch something. So I said, wait, do you want to review this?
Yeah.
I think this is, you know, go in.
It's a documentary. It's not. We're not asking you, any of you guys, to watch, you know, a jiu-jitsu battle for 100.
This is going to be much less of us talking about, you know, technique or certain aspects of fighting versus the story of a promotion, which I think has lots of carryover to anything we talk about with a pro wrestling company and its rise and a period where they were absolutely in shambles in the late 90s.
I'm really excited to watch this just because the production value looks fantastic from what I've seen of it, and I just simply like to see how, you know, they shape the storyline of you know, how the UFC was born, how it ended up being transferred to the Fertittas and Dana, and of course what matches they pick out from their history that they would, you know, claim to be the most important
and which ones they ignore. So we'll talk about that next week. It's going to be the UFC's Fighting for a Generation documentary, and in 2 weeks we will get back to wrestling.
I feel like we're being too apologetic here.
Hey, well, listen, there's a lot of people who it's just, they don't follow MMA. And
so what? Not everybody likes WCW. Not everybody wants to hear about, you know, WWF. Not everybody wants to hear about ECW. Yeah. Not everybody wants to hear about an ROH or a Japanese review.
I feel at this point, listen, if there's 1 week where you're not down with the show, listen, we throw out tons of shows. There's lots of stuff you can listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 hours next week, we're going to chat about the history of the UFC, because I'm very much looking forward to doing this show with you. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I've already watched the documentary. Lots of stuff to discuss. And if you maybe want a primer, I did want to mention this. Over at SureDog.com, Jack Encarnacio, who's a fantastic host, he's been tackling a project that is insane. He's been doing, for the past month, these different installments looking back at the history of the UFC, and each podcast covers 10 UFC-numbered events at a time. And he's had a lot of big, you know, media members from Dave Meltzer, Josh Gross, Jordan Breen, and he had me on. I believe the show is up now at SureDog.com. That's the SureDog Rewind. I'm chatting UFC 121 through 130. So if you want to hear me and Jack chat for 3 hours about these 10 events, you can go on over SureDog.com/radio. It's also on iTunes. So I encourage you, check them out. They're great shows from different members of the media. John Anik did one of the shows. So lots of great stuff that you can check on over there. And it can set you up for next week's show when me and Wei will discuss the history of the Ultimate Fighting Championship, or as it was first dubbed on the first broadcast, the Ultimate Fighting Challenge.
Yes.
Anyway, by Bill Wallace. So we'll get on out of here. You can go on over. LiveAudioWrestling.com is your place to go. LawRadio.ProBoards.com is our message board. Lots of fun interactivity. You can post your questions there for the Law each week now, as well as get all of our shows. Subscribe to the Law Live Audio Wrestling on iTunes. And you can follow us at Law Radio, at Wei0937. Wei is on Instagram and Twitter. Very easily accessible.
Yeah, they know all this stuff.
All right. Well, I just feel I need to hammer it home every single week. So we're going to get on out of here, Wei. And I guess we need some music to close things out this week. And, man, WCW Mayhem, 1999. What's coming to mind?
How about the Bret Hart theme song? The all-too-classic Bret Hart WCW theme.
There you go. Let's play a game, folks, of what comes to mind. The legendary Canadian wrestler, or the music you would get on, like, the display menu of the WCW Backstage Assault video game.
I believe it was actually the theme music for, the WCW Thunder game.
Really?
The menu music from the WCW Thunder game.
Lift it. That's what we can use for Bret. All right, here you go. The not-so-classic Bret Hart theme.